Good morning, everyone. It's good to be here with you. It's interesting that Galen picked Psalm 119 to read from because I had been reading through that psalm while I was thinking about this message and finally decided that it was just way too big to even bring into this message, and so it got cut. But I had been reading those very same verses this past week. This morning, my title of my message is The Test of the Heart. And the children could come forward if they would like, and I'll have a few things to say to you all. And I have something to give you, so if the children want to come forward, I would like to give each of you something. And you can come up here, Grayson. Grayson, you can come here. I have something to give you. You can go sit down. Anybody else want this? All right. Emmy? How about you? There you go. I'll give you one. There you go. Jesse? And you want one, Ethan? Okay, so do you all like tests? Probably most of us don't really enjoy tests. They can be difficult and stressful, and especially if they're timed, then they can be really stressful. And they're also intimidating because depending how we perform on the test, it could reflect negatively on maybe our intelligence or our knowledge or maybe even our study habits. But tests are very important because academic progress is really hard to judge. Like, I can't just look at Winston back there and just look at the angle of his nose or the locus of his eyes and tell whether he's mastered geometry or not. Okay, but if I have a good test and I give it to him, then I can determine how well he knows math, right? So tests can reveal some of those hidden, elusive things that are deep inside of us. Now, far more difficult than testing somebody's math skills or their history knowledge is testing somebody's heart. And it's so difficult that we probably shouldn't be testing other people's hearts or judging other people's hearts very much. But how can we know what's in our own heart? Is there a test for our heart? And I'm not talking about the muscle beating in my chest, but like the center of our love and affection. How can we test that? Jesus was asked one time, what's the first commandment of all? And he said, "Hear, O Israel," and he was quoting Deuteronomy. He said, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. This is the first commandment." Then he gave the second one too. So what does it mean to love God with all of our heart? And how can we know if we're loving God with all of our heart? Is there a test for that? Several weeks ago in my Bible reading in the morning, I read about two kings who gave two tests. And we're going to talk about some of that this morning. You know, most tests are not very subtle. They're not very sneaky. Like, it just says at the top of the page in bold words, test. But some tests, we don't even know they're a test. That the people getting the test don't even know it's a test. And when I was your age, I was about 8 years old, I had a test that was kind of like that. And in fact, it was the same test I just gave you, the same test that you all failed. But it's okay, because I failed it too. So there was a visiting preacher who came to Bethel, and he had all of the children come forward, and he gave each one a coin. I think it maybe was a dime back then. I gave you quarters. But then he had us all stand to one side, except one boy, it was Andy Schrock. He went and was told to go stand on the other side. And after it was all done, the preacher told us that only one boy had said thank you for the quarter or the dime. And I remember feeling just a little bit annoyed that I hadn't said thank you. If I had known what the preacher was getting, was after, looking for, I would have said thank you. And it's also true that if I would have been more thankful, I might have said thank you as well. But that test, I didn't even know it was a test, but it revealed something about my heart, right? So you all just got tested and you didn't even know it. And that's the way some of these tests are. And the tests we're going to talk about this morning are that kind of a test. The people didn't even realize it was a test when it happened. All right. You can go back to your seats. So this morning I would like to look at not just two kings, but three kings and three tests as we think about this idea of our hearts, the condition of our hearts, and tests that reveal what the condition of our hearts is. Do I love God with all of my heart? And you can turn to 2 Samuel for the first one. Turn to 2 Samuel chapter 9. David is the king, but Mephibosheth is the main character here. So Mephibosheth was a young man, young child with a bright future. He was born royalty. His grandfather, King Saul, was king of Israel. His father, Jonathan, was a good man. He had everything going for him. But that all changed one day when he was 5 years old and he got word that Saul and his father, Jonathan, had been killed in battle. And in the panic of the moment, his nurse picked him up. They ran and his nurse dropped him. And so in one day, he became not only an orphan, but also a cripple. And then years later, after Mephibosheth had grown up and had a son of his own, David was well established as king at that point, and he looked through all of Israel to find somebody of the house of Saul that he could show kindness to. And he said he wanted to do that for Jonathan's sake. And they found an old servant of Saul's who knew of Jonathan's crippled son and told David about him. And so David summoned Mephibosheth to come meet him. And we can only imagine what was going through Mephibosheth's mind. If you read through these stories of the kings, it wasn't uncommon for kings to kind of clean house when they took power and kill anyone who was maybe related to the former king, part of that family, or anybody who might still be loyal to the former king. So what was Mephibosheth thinking? Was he worried that maybe his life was about to end and maybe his young son would be an orphan just like he had grown up? Anyway, Mephibosheth came to David, and it says in 2 Samuel chapter 9, verse 6, that now when Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David, he fell on his face and prostrated himself. Then David said, "Mephibosheth," and he answered, "Here is your servant." So David said to him, "Do not fear, for I will surely show you kindness for Jonathan, your father's sake, and will restore to you all the land of Saul, your grandfather, and you shall eat bread at my table continually." So clearly David could see the fear in Mephibosheth, and he tried to reassure him. And he gave him all of Saul's land, and then he put Saul's servant, Ziba, in charge of it to take care of it. But he said Mephibosheth was to eat at David's table. every day. And so that's what Mephibosheth did. He stayed in Jerusalem and ate continually at the king's table, even though he was lame in both feet and couldn't do much, but he was honored in this way. We next read about Mephibosheth in 2 Samuel chapter 16, I believe. And this is after Absalom rebelled against King David, and David had to flee Jerusalem for his life. Chapter 16, verse 1. When David was a little past the top of the mountain, there was Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, who met him with a couple of saddled donkeys, and on them 200 loaves of bread, 100 clusters of raisins, 100 summer fruits, and a skin of wine. And the king said to Ziba, "What do you mean to do with these?" So Ziba said, "The donkeys are for the king's household to ride on, the bread and the summer fruit for the young men to eat, and the wine for those who are faint in the wilderness." Then the king said, "And where is your master's son? Where is Mephibosheth?" And Ziba said to the king, "Indeed, he is staying in Jerusalem, for he said, 'Today the house of Israel will restore the kingdom of my father to me.'" So the king said to Ziba, "Here, all that belongs to Mephibosheth is yours." And Ziba said, "I humbly bow before you, that I may find favor in your sight, my lord, O king." So Ziba had this story about Mephibosheth, and he was there to support David in his time of need. Mephibosheth was missing, and so everything that was Mephibosheth's was given to Ziba. And then Mephibosheth shows up again in chapter 19, verse 24, as David, after Absalom was killed, and David is now returning to Jerusalem. Chapter 19, verse 24. "Now Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king, and he had not cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he returned in peace. So it was, when he had come to Jerusalem to meet the king, that the king said to him, 'Why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth?' And he answered, 'My lord, O king, my servant deceived me. For your servant said, I will saddle a donkey for myself, that I may ride on it and go to the king, because your servant is lame. And he has slandered your servant to my lord the king. But my lord the king is like the angel of God. Therefore, do whatever is good in your eyes. For all my father's house were dead men before my lord the king. Yet you set your servant among those who eat at your own table. Therefore, what right have I still to cry out any more to the king?' So the king said to him, 'Why do you speak any more of your matters? I have said, you and Ziba divide the land.'" So here we see in verse 27 that Mephibosheth, well, I guess the first indication that something was up with Ziba's story was the fact that Mephibosheth hadn't washed his clothes or taken care of himself for a long time when he came to meet David. And those donkeys that Mephibosheth was going to ride, what happened to them? Well, maybe they are the ones that Ziba used to haul the food to David. And then Mephibosheth was left with no transportation. And remember, he was lame. So Mephibosheth put himself at the mercy of David in verse 27. He says, "My lord the king is like the angel of God. Therefore, just do whatever is right in your eyes." And he realized where he had come from. He was completely humble. He said in verse 28, "All of my father's house were but dead men." He realized that he could have very well been killed, and yet, because of David's mercy, he was alive at this point. And so he just put himself completely at David's mercy here. Now, here we have a case of one man's word against another. Ziba had one account of what happened. Mephibosheth gave his story. What was David going to do? David said, here, you split the land. And what was Mephibosheth's response to that? Well, his response was in verse 30. Then Mephibosheth said to the king, rather, let him take it all, inasmuch as my lord the king has come back in peace to his own house. So do you see the test here? Half of what had been Mephibosheth's was given to Ziba, the man who had betrayed him and slandered him. And Mephibosheth, rather than being upset about losing half his land, rather than wishing revenge on Ziba and justice, his sole focus was on David's well-being, David's safety, and just thankful and grateful that he could be back in the presence of David and that David was well. His desire, his love and gratitude toward David far outweighed any desire for revenge or for his own selfish desires for land. In 1 Kings 3, there's another king and another test, and we're not going to read this all, but it's a very familiar story of Solomon. Two women had given birth to two boys, and one tragically died during the night. And so the mother of the dead boy switched the babies, and then in the morning there was an argument about who was the real mother of the living baby. And so they ended up in Solomon's court. And here we have another case of one man's word against the other, except it was one woman's word against another. And there have been several times when I've sat in a courtroom as an observer and have heard two sides of a case, and they don't line up. And I've wondered, how in the world is the judge going to decide what the truth is? And I'm sure that's what was going through the minds of these people in Solomon's court. Each woman was just like the other. Each woman had this very same story. The living baby was theirs, and there was no way to tell. What was Solomon going to do? How in the world could he tell which one deserved the baby? And I can imagine that as Solomon said, bring a sword, that there was a lot of little gasps around the courtroom. It's not, the timeline isn't totally clear, but in the last chapter, 1 Kings 2, Solomon, early in his reign, had just performed three executions. He had killed his brother Adonijah. He had killed Joab. He had killed Shimei, who had insulted David. He knew how to use a sword, and he wasn't afraid to do it. But what happened? Well, we know what happened. The true mother said in verse 26 of chapter 3, O my Lord, give her the living child and by no means kill him. The other woman said, let him be neither mine nor yours, but divide him. So do you see the test? The true mother was about to lose her baby. And yet it was still fair in a way. The baby would just be divided. Neither one would get him. However, her love for her baby far, far outweighed any desire to win the argument or to see her lying roommate suffer. She wanted to give up the child in order to spare its life. And her response revealed the state of her heart. One mother was motivated by spite and selfishness, but the real mother was motivated by love, and that became apparent in her response. The third king I'd like to look at is in Matthew 19. And this is Jesus. Not everybody realized he was a king at this time. This is the account of the rich young ruler. And he came to Jesus and said, "What good thing must I do to have eternal life?" And Jesus explained that he needs to keep the commandments. Well, then he wanted some clarification. Well, which commandments? Which ones do I need to keep? So Jesus listed several. You shall not murder, verse 18. You shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness. Honor your father and your mother, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And then the man said, "Well, I've kept all of these since I've been young." And then Jesus, who knew what part of his heart he had reserved for himself, said, "If you want to be perfect, go sell what you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, and come follow me." But when the young man heard that saying, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. So do you see the test here? This was a righteous man who had carefully kept the law from his youth. But Jesus knew his heart, and he went right to the part of his heart that he had not yielded to God, and gave him a test that revealed that to the man, to himself. God's will ran counter to this man's will. And he chose his own way. He was not living in a state of unconditional surrender, and therefore he failed the test. There's one more passage I would like to read in Luke 14. And this is again about Jesus. Jesus excelled at revealing people's hearts. And this is a parable, Luke 14, starting at verse 15, is the parable of the Great Supper. And Jesus told this parable while he was enjoying a Sabbath meal at the house of a ruler of the Pharisees. And I can imagine this was a little bit of a tense meal, maybe a fatted calf and hatred kind of meal instead of a herbs and love kind of meal. And Jesus had healed a man, which raised some eyebrows because it was the Sabbath. And then he had been critical of those who take the best seat in the house. And then he tells this parable of the Great Supper. Luke 14, starting at verse 15. "Now when one of those who sat at the table with him heard these things, he said to him, 'Blessed is he who shall eat bread in the kingdom of God.' Then he said to him, 'A certain man gave a great supper and invited many and sent his servants at supper time to say to those who were invited, "Come, for all things are now ready." But they all with one accord began to make excuses. The first said to him, "I have bought a piece of ground and I must go see it. I ask you to have me excused." And another said, "I have bought 5 yoke of oxen and I am going to test them. I ask you to have me excused." Still another said, "I have married a wife, and therefore I cannot come." So that servant came and reported these things to his master. Then the master of the house, being angry, said to his servants, "Go out quickly into the streets and lanes of the city, and bring in here the poor and the maimed, and the lame and the blind." And the servant said, "Master, it is done as you have commanded, and still there is room." Then the master said to the servant, "Go out into the highways and the hedges and compel them to come in, that my house may be filled. For I say to you that none of those men who were invited shall taste my supper." Now great multitudes went with him, and he turned and said to them, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And whoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. These people who were invited had three excuses. One had a piece of land, one had bought some oxen he needed to try, and one had married a wife. I don't know that they were opposed to coming to the banquet. They just had more important things to do. So this test that they were given, multiple choice test, you could say, are you coming or not? They failed the test. This test revealed where their true affections were really placed. We'll talk a little more about verses 25 through 27 in a few minutes. So in these accounts, these three kings, David, Solomon, and Jesus, and these tests they gave to people, which revealed the condition of people's hearts, what are some lessons that we can learn from these stories? And I have three lessons. The first is that the state of the heart is not obvious, generally. Ziba was a respectful and obedient servant. He cared for David when David was in a time of extreme need. He seemed like a very decent guy. And yet it seems like, when we look at the entire story, that his good deeds were motivated primarily by self-interest. The lying mother in King Solomon's court had a story that sounded just as good as the true mother, and she was very cooperative and agreeable with Solomon's judgment, but she had no love in her heart. The rich young ruler was a respectable young man who lived an upright life, seemed to have life figured out, and yet his heart was with his treasure. The people who missed the Great Supper were normal, hard-working, productive members of society, but their preoccupation with their things and even their family roused the anger of the master who had invited them. So it's not always easy to tell the state of the heart. Things can look pretty good on the outside and not be that way on the inside. The second lesson is that a heart devoted to God requires no special ability or skill. Every one of us has what it takes to love God well, I believe. Mephibosheth was only a cripple and an orphan from a disgraced family. He really had nothing to offer King David. And yet he was filled with love for David and gratitude for what David had done to him and for the mercy that David had shown him. He did not have an attitude of entitlement. He didn't feel like he deserved the land that was given to Ziba, but he just humbly acknowledged that his very life was a gift from David and that his future was in David's hands. The mother of the living baby, the true mother, was completely powerless to do anything to save her baby and to correct this injustice. And yet she could love, and that's what she did, and that ended up saving her baby. I don't even know if I mentioned the end of that story, but we know it. It has a happy ending. She was given the living baby. Solomon knew what was in her heart and that she was the true mother. The rich young ruler's talents and wealth, far from being an asset to him, were actually a hindrance. Probably he was the envy of those around him. And yet, that wealth and his love for it was a prison that held him back from a relationship, a disciple-master relationship with the creator of the universe walking right there in his town. The people who ultimately enjoyed the Great Supper were the poor, the maimed, the lame, and the blind. They were from the highways and the hedges. They were certainly not the most respected or the most affluent people around, but they appreciated the invitation enough to respond and attend. A heart devoted to God doesn't require a great amount of skill or ability or talent. It just requires gratitude and humility. And we're all capable of doing that. Not one of us is too poor or too worthless or too unskilled for God. And the third thing I think we can learn from these stories is that our response to adversity and to prosperity reveals the state of our hearts. Adversity and prosperity are tests that can tell us something about the condition of our hearts and our love. Mephibosheth experienced slander, betrayal, and loss of half his wealth, and yet his focus was not on punishment, but his focus was on David and enjoying his presence and his favor. By contrast, the rich young ruler immediately lost interest in Jesus when he realized that it might cost him some of his wealth or all of his wealth. So when we are faced with slander or mistreatment, when our reputation is threatened, can we focus on loving Jesus and living in obedience to his commands and responding the way in a Christ-like way? When following Jesus becomes really costly, can we continue trusting him and living in obedience to him, whatever the cost? Our response to adversity and trouble says something about our level of love and the state of our heart. At the end of that parable about the Great Supper, there are those verses about hating father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters. And he says, yes, and even our own lives. We need to hate our own life in order to be Jesus' disciple. In Matthew 10, there's similar verses, and the wording there is, he who loves father or mother, brother or sister more than me is not worthy of me. And so we see that putting anything above love for Jesus can be a problem. To those of us who share the beliefs and convictions of our parents, this might be a little hard to relate to, but there are those who have to choose between fellowship with their parents or following Jesus. Probably all of us wish for a happy, healthy family. If that doesn't happen, for whatever reason, are we able to lay those dreams at Jesus' feet and trust him and follow him at whatever the cost? I think these verses show that even something as good and right as family can be valued above Jesus and can make us unworthy. But our response to these things says something about the state of our heart. Perhaps life is good, busy, but good. We have lots to do and lots to enjoy, and that's all good. But how are we handling this prosperity? Are we available for the work of the Lord? Or are there certain callings that just don't really mesh with our dreams and our personal commitments? Do we have time to seek the Lord? Or are we so busy with church, job, and family responsibilities that we're just happy to make it through the week and not fail somebody or forget something? You know, this is not a simple topic. Not all callings suit everybody. We have giftings. Not all busyness is bad. We sure hope not, right? But are we handling prosperity well? Are we allowing our affections to be stolen, or are they fixed on Jesus? So wrapping up here, Jesus said that the first commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart and your mind, strength, and soul. Life is full of tests, hard things, and sometimes prosperity that reveal the state of our hearts. Circumstances that require self-denial. Circumstances that reveal the object of our affection or the location of our treasure. And my challenge from these stories to you and for myself is that we don't fail these tests like the rich young ruler or like the people who were first invited to the Great Supper, but rather that we pass with flying colors like Mephibosheth, and we give Jesus all of our heart, and we recognize that Jesus took notice of us, a dead dog, in the words of Mephibosheth, and he honored us with a seat at his table, and for that, we should give him our whole heart and let nothing steal a part of it or get in the way. So thank you for your attention.